everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our theme today, we're going to talk with an activist, Eva Bartlett, about her years of living in Gaza. She lived there 5 years, three full time, and what she learned from her perspective about the conflict between the Palestinian and the Knesset and Netanyahu and his Likud party, what life is like. Why are not the American media and other world media telling the truth about this? She's not afraid of the truth. She's the one who told us the truth last week about Assad not using sarin gas on his own citizens. Those were terrorists supported by the United States and other countries. How we supported and financed and trained and then protected the terrorist groups. This will be no less revealing. This is an interview of Eva Bartlett, and I think you'll find it of interest.
We need to hear about Gaza. We need to know what's happening. If you would paint a portrait of life in Gaza and tell us what's happening there, we'd appreciate it.
There's a lot happening. It's hard to fit it in a 45-minute segment, but I'll try to discuss the most critical issues, in my opinion, and those being that Gaza is under a full lockdown, a siege or a blockade, enforced by the Israelis and also by the Egyptian authorities, and of course backed by the West, including Canada, my own country. Mm-hmm. And this siege or blockade impacts on every single aspect of their lives. And it's not merely, the siege on. It's most of the time in the corporate media it's described as an economic siege, but it's a siege on all aspects of life. But then in addition to the siege, there's other things going on that most people don't get a chance to hear about, and it's been going on for years and years and years. And that, for example, the attack on agriculture in Gaza and the attack on fishing in Gaza, which impacts on the individuals who are being attacked, and it impacts on the society as a whole, because if you're not able to produce the vegetables and grains that formerly were abundant in Gaza, and if you're not able to access and harvest the sea, as is the tradition in Gaza, then the society as a whole can't access affordable food. So it impacts on the population as a whole, and with 80% of the population dependent on food aid, this is significant. They now have to survive on flour, sugar, oil, a very high carbohydrate, high oil diet, causing therefore an increase in things like anemia in women and children, diabetes, other sorts of health risks, and also impacting on the health. But then when you look back at the individuals, the farmers that can no longer access their land, it's in addition to the overall poverty in Gaza. So poverty and unemployment is basically at 40%, and it's been so for years.
So you have a situation where it's difficult to grow goods in Gaza because mm-hmm. farmers don't have access to the land or are often sniped at, and food can't come in from the outside. That is, very little can come in through the checkpoints.
It does actually come in. The problem is that because 80% of the population lives on less than $2 a day, they can't afford to buy the Israeli produce that comes in. Mm-hmm. And so that's critical. And again, when Palestinian farmers were able to grow a lot of produce, the area that they cannot access was known as the breadbasket in Gaza. Now it's more like an arid, mm-hmm. Desolate area. And it's not for lack of, the farmer's skill or that the land is not fertile. It's quite the opposite. It's because you mentioned sniping. So basically, first of all, Gaza is a very small place, right? It's 40 kilometers long. There's 1.7 million people living in the place and in the strip. And if you can advance the photos to the map of, with the red line, yes. So basically, they cannot access one-third of their farmland. And when they do try to, they're either sniped at, machine gun fired, mm-hmm. or they're shelled. And they're done so with some of the most high precision technology in the world, right? Because Israel obviously is the strongest military in that region, and they have high precision surveillance equipment. So they can see down to, you know, the plaid of your shirt. They know who they're targeting, and they continue to assault men, women, children, elderly, young, who are in the border region simply trying to farm their land. And again, because the media does not report this, if it's at all reported that another Palestinian has been killed in the border regions, it will be that this person posed a security threat to the mighty state of Israel. When in fact, in most cases, it's that these people were on their land, even outside of what the Israelis arbitrarily impose, the 300-meter so-called no-go zone. Palestinians are routinely targeted beyond 300 meters, 500 meters, a kilometer and a half, 2 kilometers away by the Israeli army.
The obvious question is why? I mean, Israel has them completely locked in. They live behind fences. They can't get out. They have very little access to food. Why is Israel targeting them to prevent them from even growing their own food? Why do you suppose they're doing this?
Well, I mean, they also target, obviously, Palestinians in the West Bank and all of occupied Palestine. Right. But in terms of Gaza, so Hamas is the government in power. Mm-hmm. Whether or not you like them as a group, they were democratically elected under elections that the West, the, you know, international bodies, both encouraged and even supervised. And Hamas was chosen. So many people view, or at least people who are knowledgeable about what Israel's doing to Palestinians in Gaza, view their policies, their attacks on all aspects of life as a means of trying to create such frustration that the people will overthrow their government. This is also known as collective punishment, and punishment for something that the population does not deserve. They've done nothing wrong. I also believe that, I mean, the Zionist ideology is to occupy all of Palestine and parts of Egypt and parts of Jordan. So to me, it seems like it's part of the genocidal policies that Israel does inflict on Palestine in all realms, including expanding the colonies in Jerusalem and the West Bank. But in terms of Gaza, it seems like it's just part of killing off more Palestinians. Either, you know, they wage their wars on Gaza every now and then and kill off, you know, people in the thousands, or a slow genocide where people are dying because they can't get kidney dialysis or they can't get proper medical treatment. Yeah.
Or they trying to create a situation that's so bad that they'll leave, that Palestinians will leave, that the kind of a transfer policy. But the irony, of course, with Gaza is they can't leave if they wanted to. Not that they would, because I don't think Palestinians are going to leave. But I think part of the Zionist plan was to make life so bad that people would leave and they would have better access to the land.
Well, I mean, the Israeli authorities even calculated, there's a document called the Red Lines document, and the Israeli rights group Gisha, which looks a lot at freedom of movement, but also in terms of Gaza and the West Bank, but also the different policies Israel imposes on Gaza. And they requested that this document be released. And the document basically outlines how many calories Palestinians in Gaza need to survive but not starve. So that shows the intent of the Israelis. That and other statements, you know, that various Israeli leaders have uttered, including when they bombed Gaza in November 2012, and the son of Ariel Sharon basically talked about destroying all of Gaza's infrastructure, not leaving any bridges or, you know, electricity or water, and the then I can't remember his position, vice prime minister or something like that, just talking about blowing Gaza back to the Stone Ages. So, and this is what they do. They do destroy the infrastructure. They destroy water and sanitation lines and bridges, and then they don't allow the construction materials in to repair the schools, the homes, the infrastructure that has been utterly destroyed.
And part of your work there, working with the ISM, is doing accompaniment, because as farmers go into the fields, as fishers go out to sea, they are attacked by the military, and ISM, you go along in order to offer some means of protection.
Protection, I guess, we can't protect them because there have been instances when the Israeli army has shot around us and targeted the farmers. In one instance, they shot a 17, I think he was 17 years old, deaf farm laborer who was trying to earn money to contribute to his family's income, and they were desperately poor. They targeted him, shot him. Thankfully, he didn't die. He wasn't one of the over, you know, 150, 170 farmers or people in the border region that have been killed by the Israeli army when they're simply working in the land. He wasn't one of them. But yeah, basically what we would do is accompany them, be a visible presence, wear bright clothing to ensure that the Israeli army narrative, oh, we saw a security threat, they were threatening to us. Well, when you see a bunch of people with farmers wearing bright clothing, literally waving at them saying, hey, we're here, we're unarmed, yeah, you know, and still being targeted, then that just highlights all the more their policies. And so our accompanying the farmers was both to enable them to be on their land, because they are being driven off their land by these policies, and also to challenge the Israeli narrative that this is all about security when it's not. We can't necessarily protect them, and in the end, we always respect the farmers' wishes. So if they want to stay in the land, we would stay with them. If they wanted to leave, we would leave. And in some cases, they were successful. They were able to either, you know, plant on their land or to harvest their crops. And in many, many cases, they weren't successful to the point where they maybe had harvested their crops and then came under fire, or they just arrived to start harvesting and came under heavy fire. And this is not like warning shots in the air. This is heavy fire whizzing past us, bullets whizzing past us. Or in other cases, their crops were bulldozed by the heavy armored bulldozers that come in every week or two all along the border and just raise the land. Or their crops were burned, incendiary devices thrown on their crops and just went up in flames. So they have a lot to contend with. And again, being among Gaza's most desperately poor, they don't have the luxury of saying, okay, I'm just going to chalas, finish, I'm not going to farm anymore, because this is their land or they're working as laborers and they have no other option.
Talk a little bit about the tunnels, because we hear that goods and produce and things get in through the tunnels from Egypt. But even that has been greatly diminished. Could you tell us what's happening with in terms of getting goods into this you know, desperate area of the world, and it's even that is being diminished, I understand.
Well, so basically after Hamas was elected, Israel, which had been imposing restrictions on Palestinians in Gaza since the 90s, since Oslo, really ramped it up and basically locked down the borders, banned exports, and to this day exports are largely banned. Every now and then they allow a truck or two out of Gaza. But the Palestinians used to export all sorts of goods, food goods, clothing, furniture, etc. And now they can't, so this is impacting on their economy and of course raising the poverty levels. But also the Israelis were extremely restricting imports. So raw materials needed in factories and construction materials, all sorts of food products, livestock, mundane things like clothing and paper and pens and toys and baby formula. That's not mundane, that's essential. Diapers. All of these were being banned. So these were the things that were coming through the tunnels. And livestock and even cattle and camels were coming through the tunnels. Even cars cut in half, apparently. I never saw it, but I was told about this. We're coming through the tunnels. Industrial fuel used to run the power plant was coming through the tunnels. But unfortunately, since the coup in Egypt, which happened last July, I believe, in 2013, the new military regime in Egypt has kind of reinforced the Mubarak policies of really enforcing the siege on Gaza. And, you know, although the Israelis maybe say, you know, all the Arab nations around them hate Israel and their enemies, Egypt is very complicit and actually does work with Israel, unfortunately. Not the people, of course, but the authorities. So the Egyptian authorities have ordered the military to basically destroy all the tunnels between Egypt and Gaza. And by most accounts I've read, 90%, 95%, or maybe all the tunnels have been destroyed.
Well, at its peak, how massive were the tunnels? How many tunnels are we talking about?
Hundreds, some people said even over 1,000, which is credible because they were literally over top of one another, Some were like 10 meters deep, some were 30 meters deep, side by side, and of varying sizes. Some were very small, so you had to stoop when you walked through them. Some were large enough to bring a vehicle sawed in half through.
So some 95% of those tunnels are now dysfunctional or not being used. So that tunnel economy is decimated.
Yes.
Yes. And it's, I think as Americans, it's difficult to understand why Egypt, an Arabic country, would be doing this until one understands where their money's coming from. Next to Israel, Egypt's the largest recipient of American aid. And so I think we see the fine handprint of the United States on how Egypt is reacting here. So it's not just Israel, I think, we're dealing with. It's Egypt as well.
Right.
Very difficult.
Right.
Very difficult.
Yeah, so with the decimation of the tunnels, then that segment of the population, again, among Gaza's poorest, are out of work. And aside from the goods that no longer can enter through the tunnels, and some of the goods that were being exported, because, again, they couldn't be exported through the borders, the Palestinians aren't able to buy the inexpensive industrial diesel needed for the power plant. So then everything that the Egyptians, or specifically the Israelis, but also the Egyptians, do to the Palestinians in Gaza impacts on every aspect of life. So not importing the industrial fuel means very little power in Gaza, which impacts on the health sector, which impacts also on the education sector, it impacts on the sanitation sector. So last November, December, the Palestinians in Gaza were getting only 2-3 hours of electricity per day. And some days they didn't have electricity at all. So hospitals not being able to function properly, the sanitation plants could not pump the sewage into the sea, which is basically what they do because they're not able to improve on their sanitation holding pools. And if they don't pump it into the sea, then the sewage accumulates and overflows into the streets. So November, December, they don't have power, the sewage accumulates, heavy rains, and so then you have this mixture of streets which are flooded with rain and sewage. And all of this is manufactured. And the people have to wade through the sewage water. And I say it's manufactured because, again, if Palestinians were able to access construction materials to improve on their sanitation facilities, and if they had regular power, then these problems could be solved very quickly.
Yeah, and the disease must be rampant in terms of raw sewage running through neighborhoods, and then you have a medical system that is terribly compromised. And you have this picture of hell, really, of people having to live this way. And the impact on children. Talk a little bit about the kids. I understand in Gaza it's something like 50% of the population are children, or some very high percentage like that.
Right.
So we're talking about this incredible population of children living in this situation.
So children are 91%, according to the Gaza Community Mental Health Program, 91% of kids have some form of traumatic stress disorder, which obviously is quite plausible because they grow up under Israeli F-16s and drones and hearing the sound of the warships firing at fishermen and shelling fishermen. But also, in addition to their, the traumatic and the psychological terror that kids grow up under, they also grow up in extreme poverty, without access to clean drinking water, drinking this brackish water that is high in nitrates and contaminated by sewage. They go to school in double shifts because there aren't enough schools to accommodate kids. And there are some schools, for example, in Hosa, which is in southeastern Gaza along the border. It's less than a kilometer from the border. And the kids are fired at when they go to school. They're fired at when they're in school. So in that instance, there are days when kids don't go to school. Classes are disrupted. With the ban, from 2007 to 10 on paper and notebooks and pens, obviously that impacts on kids' ability to get education. With the electricity cuts, kids have to study by candlelight or not at all. And just there's chronic malnutrition among children. There's rising anemia among infants. There's stunted growth among children. And then growing up extremely poor, many children actually work whatever they can to contribute to their family's income. So kids selling, you know, trinkets on the street like gum or napkins, kids collecting plastics to be sold, recyclables to be sold, and more critically, children working in the border regions where many houses have been destroyed and there is thus rubble. And so because construction materials are banned in Gaza, what people do is collect rubble, grind it down, and use that in construction. Mm-hmm. So kids will actually go to the border region where these houses have been destroyed and collect the rubble. And of course, then they're fired upon by the Israeli army. And Defense for Children International has well documented the cases of kids who are injured in the border region either by firing or by shelling. And they're either collecting rubble or they're working as farmers. So kids do not have a healthy life in Gaza. Nonetheless, they're of course incredibly bright, and you know, like most Palestinians, they love education. They're creative, etc. And there are some kids that are among the more privileged. Maybe their families aren't desperately poor. That of course segment would be very small. But those kids, then they study, you know, music, and they study art, and there's good things for kids in Gaza. But I mean, it's just they're under insurmountable odds.
Now, you've lived in Gaza for over 5 years. Well, that's amazing to me that you've been there so long.
It's actually 3 years. Over
3 years.
Year,
oh, I thought
years.
You went in 2008.
I did, but I've been back and forth.
Oh, okay. So, but you did go in, and you went in on a flotilla, a creative way to get into Gaza, and we need creative ways to get into Gaza. Went in on a flotilla in 2008, and... And then shortly after that, there was the massive attack, Operation Cast Lead, in December of 2008. Could you talk about your experiences with that? You lived through that, and
well, so in the lead up to the attacks, first of all, Hamas and Israel had signed a truce in June 2008, and Israel, from the very beginning, was violating the truce. Flying their war planes into Gaza's airspace, firing on farmers, firing on fishers. And part of the truce was also to allow more imports and to allow exports, period. And none of this happened. So right from the beginning, the Israelis were violating the truce. Hamas actually kept its bargain, which was to restrict their resistance from firing rockets to Israel. But then in November, Israel assassinated a number of Hamas members. And then there were bombings even prior to the full-on onslaught on December 27th. So I think it's important to note that, because that's largely excluded from the corporate
Very
media
important.
Narrative.
And
that Hamas was really working towards some sort of peace. So anyway, then on December 27th, the Israeli Air Force bombed police stations throughout the Gaza Strip. And in the first day alone, hundreds had been killed. And when they bombed police stations, they were targeting civil police, traffic police, law enforcement. And their narrative that they were targeting so-called terrorists was complete and utter nonsense, because what they were doing was targeting the population. And it was just another realm of their collective punishment of Gaza. And of course, when they were bombing the police stations, they were hitting many, many, many innocent bystanders. And the police themselves were innocent. I mean, they're, again, civil police, many of whom would have worked for Fatah when they were in power. But then, yeah, for the next 23 days, because many people cite, you know, the attacks of being 22 days, but I do say 23 days because even after the ceasefire was declared, the Israelis bombed Gaza. So it continued into the 23rd day. But for those days, basically the Israeli warplanes, you know, the F-16s and the precision drones were relentlessly bombing all over Gaza. Any place was a target. So, you know, in the end, you had 16 medics killed by the Israeli army, intentionally killed, you know, either shot or shelled, including a medic I worked with who was killed by a dart bomb, which was fired at his ambulance as he was loading people into the ambulance. So he was basically shredded with darts, went into shock and died. You had 29 or 30 ambulances destroyed, and obviously Gaza's health sector was already crippled by the you know, blockade and the lack of allowing or the preventing, you know, replacement parts or ambulances from coming into Gaza. hospitals were attacked, including with white phosphorus. Schools were attacked with white phosphorus. Right. Homes were attacked with white phosphorus.
Yeah, I want to talk about that a minute, because we made such an issue about the fact that in Syria they were using chemical weapons, and yet Israel uses them all the time, white phosphorus, and uses them. And the mainstream media and our government, no one makes an issue about that at all. I mean, talk about white phosphorus, because It is just unbelievable what white phosphorus does.
Well, yeah, and I'd just like to, in terms of Syria, just note that these were allegations that the government used white phosphorus, and later It turned out to be, in fact, considerable evidence that the so-called rebel terrorists used the white phosphorus, or not white phosphorus, chemical weapons in Syria. So I think that's important, because it in turn leads to prolonging what's going on in Syria. Mm-hmm. But anyway, with regards to Gaza, Israel used it, white phosphorus, over and over in a densely inhabited area where it's forbidden under, you know, whatever international laws are applicable to war. It's forbidden to use white phosphorus in an area where civilians reside. And that's what Israel did. They bombed the Fakura school, killing 43 people. They bombed the Abu Halima family, killing 7 people with white phosphorus. They bombed, I found evidence of white phosphorus use all over Gaza, in the west, in the east, on a rehabilitation hospital. It was bombed with white phosphorus. The Al-Quds hospital in Gaza City was bombed with white phosphorus. So basically, this chemical weapon, when a person is hit with white phosphorus, you cannot extinguish it. It keeps burning and burning. The only way to extinguish it is to completely deprive it of oxygen, which you can't do to a person. Mm-hmm. I, for example, found clumps of the sponges imbued with white phosphorus in different areas, and it had been covered. They had been covered by soil or by rubble, so they had been suffocated. But once you poked at them and introduced oxygen into them again, they lit up really quickly and burned extremely brightly. So in the case of civilians that were hit, people that were hit with white phosphorus, it's a ghastly death. And I met some of the survivors who were hit with white phosphorus, but their whole body didn't catch fire. So, you know, their faces are mutilated from the burning. Mm-hmm. One woman who I met was badly mutilated and later died of her injuries. So it's a horrible way to die. And it is important to note that various human rights organizations did document that Israel used white phosphorus. I myself documented it. Other journalists documented it. And nobody has held Israel accountable.
No. And and other anti-personnel, you talk about the DART bombs, which are just, they're anti-personnel. They're created to destroy human flesh. I mean, it's just, it's incredible that that's the kind of weaponry that's being. It's bad enough to bomb, but when you bomb using ammunition aimed at destroying human beings in vicious and terrible and extremely painful ways, that's just extraordinary. And all too often, you see on the shelves of discarded ammunition made in the USA. I mean, this is what we're doing. I mean, we're making it, and we're paying for it. It's just
So that the medic that I mentioned, Arafa, who was killed by the DART bomb, then I believe it was the next day, either the same day or the next day, the family and the community tried to hold their mourning ceremony. So usually they have 3 days of mourning in which friends and well-wishers come and pay their respects. And the way it works in Gaza is that they'll erect these tents, and the men will sit outside in the tents, and people will come and pay their respects. The mourning tent was bombed with a DART bomb, and so more people were killed. And it was bombed, I believe, 2 times, because it was bombed, people came to help, and it was bombed again. And this is another aspect of the criminality that Israel did in Gaza, in that they often bombed places immediately, one after another, the double tap or double bombing technique. And they did it with drone bombings, for example, wherein they'd bomb an area, and then 3 minutes later, they'd bomb it again. So anybody who came to help was then a target.
Yeah.
It's and aside from that, aside from the chemical weapons and the illegal weapons, the Israeli soldiers shot people point blank. So, for example, I met the family, Al-Helu family, whose the man's father was shot point blank. They were basically taking sanctuary in a stairwell. And this was in the kind of, I can't remember the name now, Zaytun area, which is basically kind of a little bit south of Gaza City in east. And the army had occupied the area. And so the family was taking shelter in their stairwell on the ground floor. The army came to the door, knocked it open, and basically they came to the door, they knocked on the door, the father opened the door, and they shot him point blank. And then they told the family to leave the house, and they later occupied the house and tore it apart, as they did in many instances. And as they left, then another soldier shot at the family, and the mother was carrying an infant, and they shot the infant. So then the infant didn't die right away. And the family then, they were told to walk down this lane. And as they walk down the lane, they're being shot at. So they take cover behind this big earth mound, which the bulldozers have plowed up. And they're denied access to medical care for the next 10 or 13 hours. So the infant dies in the mother's arms. Yeah. This is just one of many instances in which they deliberately assassinated people.
Talk a bit about the medical, the hospitals. Even on good days, there's not much there. But during Caslet and these bombings, what impact does that have on the medical system, on the hospitals? What's it like? What's the scene?
Well, yeah, so like you said, during so-called good times, the hospitals are already struggling for want of electricity, for want of essential medicines, which are roughly have been for the last 6-7 years at zero stock. 50% of essential medicines have been at zero stock. So even in good times, the hospitals struggle to do operations or provide medical care to the people that need it, which is why there's so many referrals for people to get care outside of Gaza. And of course, many of these patients are not allowed out through errors, the Israeli crossing, and can't get that care. But then when you have a time of attacks, for example, so the main hospital in Gaza is Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. And on the first day, when hundreds of people were coming into the hospital with critical injuries, they did not have the means to care for them. They did not have the beds or the life support equipment, like mechanical ventilators. And many of the critical, well, not many, the majority of the critical cases simply had to wait until somebody died in the ICU so they could get a bed. So they were being laid down on floors until a bed in the ICU was cleared because somebody had died, and then they'd get that bed and more often than not would die. So, for example, when I went to the ICU to see who these critically injured people were, the nurse was telling me about different cases, about this boy who was walking near a mosque when it was bombed because the Israelis were targeting what the nurse said was a political man. So again, collateral damage, boy walking near a mosque. And he had a massive head injury. And as the nurse walked me through the ICU, he pointed out person after person after person who, in addition to the shrapnel injuries, had brain matter out and wasn't going to survive. The hospitals could not cope with the influx of casualties. And then later on in the attacks, you had hospitals being bombed themselves. For example, the Al-Quds Hospital, also in Gaza City, in a different district of Gaza City. In an area, Tel al-Hawa, where the Israeli army had invaded, was terrorizing people, bombing their homes or apartments, shooting at their homes or apartments. And as people fled and tried to take sanctuary in the hospital in that area, they were being fired upon and killed. And then finally it culminated in the Israeli army actually bombing the hospital itself. So then the patients in that hospital had to be evacuated to the Shifa Hospital, which already had no room for people. Yeah. I mean, it was just an extraordinary situation. And Mads Gilbert, who is a Norwegian doctor who does excellent work in solidarity with Palestinians, he was in Shifa Hospital. And he's done a lot of talking about what he was seeing, in terms of injuries and chemical weapons and illegal weapons. But he also made the point that, and he's been involved in, solidarity with Palestinians. He also did what we were doing, riding in ambulances many years back. He did it. But he said, and it's a good point, it's the only situation in modern warfare, although of course it was not a war between Gaza and Israel, it was a war on Gaza. It's the only situation that he's aware of in which the people were completely locked in an area and not able to flee and were being bombed and gunned down. In other areas, people in countries could at least flee to the north or to the east, whatever. Mm-hmm. In Gaza, they were locked in. They had no bomb shelters, and they were being bombed everywhere. Was being bombed, mosques, kindergarten, schools, etc.
Nowhere to go.
No.
Fish in a barrel.
Totally.
Yeah. You mentioned, and I'd like to go back to it, a little bit about the fissures. Gaza's on the sea, it had a fishing industry. People make their living at sea, but talk about the plight of the fishers.
It's an important issue, and as a freelance journalist, I used to write over and over and over again about the issue of the fishers and the farmers, and I know that in terms of media, you're not supposed to do that because it's a story, it's done, but the fact is that their existence is under attack every day. Most accounts I've read put the number of fishers as having been about 3,700, and now only about 10% of the fishers are trying to fish because of the various policies enforced on them. So basically, whereas they should be allowed to access 20 nautical miles off the coast, the waters 20 nautical miles off the coast, the Israeli authorities via the Navy have restricted them to anywhere from a mere 6 miles to 3 miles. So you put a number of fishers who were formerly accessing the deeper waters where the migrational fish were passing through into now a mere 3 mile limit, and they have nothing to fish for.
The fish are out.
They're out.
And they're out of the 20 mile, yeah.
And the fish that happen to be in that 3 mile area are also swimming in sewage water. Yeah. So then they're fishing contaminated fish. So, and then there's the point of how this 3 mile limit is enforced. And it's enforced with the same savagery that the Army enforces, like the so-called buffer zone in the border regions, in that the Navy will attack fishers even with more intensity. They'll attack with heavy-duty machine gun fire. And they've killed, I believe it's at least 9 fishers in the last decade, injured hundreds more. They'll machine gun fire them. They'll attack them with shelling. They'll attack them with heavy-duty water cannoning, including putting a chemical in it, which makes them smell like excrement for days. And these are all policies of, you know, it has absolutely nothing to do with Israeli security. For example, there's a type of boat called a hassaka, which is marginally larger than a surfboard. And about 2 people will stand on the hassaka and paddle the way out and drop their nets. And later, about 5 or 6 men will work as a team and pull the nets in. So these people who are standing on this surfboard-like boat are extremely vulnerable. They're utterly exposed to the Israeli Navy, and they come under gunfire by the Israeli Navy. They pose no threat whatsoever to the Navy, but nonetheless they are attacked ruthlessly. And the Navy will come within even the arbitrarily imposed limit, whether it's 6 miles or 3 miles, and they'll attack the fishers. And many of the fishers who are out and are being attacked, if they're able to reel in their nets, which takes about 5 minutes because they don't have high-tech equipment, it's just they're reeling them in. And if they're able to escape the attack and move to a different location, often they'll be attacked again and again and again. So it's a horrible, dangerous existence. And then in addition to that, they're often abducted by the Israeli Navy. So they're made to strip down to their underwear, dive into the sea. Often they're made to swim in the water or tread water for long periods, hauled aboard the Israeli gunboats, taken to Israeli detention. And then they're interrogated about who they know, who their brothers work for, what their brothers do, what their cousins do, what their neighbors do. And in fact, apparently the Israeli intelligence knows precisely everything about them. I mean, I think they know essentially every single person in Gaza. They have all the surveillance in equipment. But with regards to fishers, they know who the fishers are. They're interrogating them both to make their lives impossible, and also they often try to coerce them into becoming an informant, which the fishers won't do, of course, as part of their network of trying to, find out more information about Palestinians. And they coerce medical patients as well into trying to become informants. And of course, the medical patients refuse to, and then they're denied exit from Gaza to get the care they need.
We don't hear much about this pressure to create collaborators that are on the Palestinians constantly, pitting their own security and safety and of their families, and these people having to make a decision about whether to become a collaborator or not, and mostly they don't. But then the screws are turned, and life becomes more and more unbearable. And this is just prevalent throughout the whole society in terms of Israel constantly trying to get information and create collaborators.
Right.
And what that does.
Yeah, and I think it is both about getting information and also dividing up society, right? I mean, they divide Palestinians geographically, physically. For example, Palestinians from Gaza formerly were able to travel to Jerusalem and the West Bank, and now they can't. So you have families who have loved ones mm-hmm. as political prisoners. They cannot exit to see their loved ones in the prisons, to visit them. They cannot, you had Palestinians that used to study in, say, Birzeit or Bethlehem, and they cannot do that any longer. So that's part of the whole dividing policy or apartheid policy, however you want to call it, separating Palestinians, right. making their lives hell in all respects, and then even cutting off any sort of continuity between them. But with regards to the medical patients, it is documented even by, you know, Physicians for Human Rights. They've done investigations into this coercing medical patients to become collaborators, which they don't do. Mm-hmm. And with regards to the Fishers, one last aspect of how they're aggressed is that not only are they abducted, and some of them, when they're abducted, actually are not released, so they become, you know, one of the numbers of the 5,000 plus mm-hmm. Palestinians in Israeli jails, but also their vessels are kept. And so if and when the Israeli Navy does return the vessels, the Palestinian fishers have to pay for the return of the vessels. And usually the vessels have been stripped of any sort of equipment and are in, you know, even damaged or destroyed.
And the ability to repair your ships?
For the fishers, the whole population is poor, but they're of the poorest of the population. Mm. And anyway, Israel doesn't allow in engines and fishing equipment. So, and now that the tunnels have been destroyed,
Like the construction material. It's like, you know, they destroy the houses, they destroy your community, and then don't allow construction materials in to repair it.
Right.
And so they destroy fishers' ships. And there's no means to repair them. Even if you had the money, couldn't get the parts probably. And mm-hmm.
I think since we've talked about America and Canada, mm-hmm. the role we play in terms of oppressing Palestinians, because America, as you said, sends billions of dollars mm-hmm. to Israel. America and Canada willfully turn blind eyes from the genocidal policies that Israel is imposing on Palestinians. Mm-hmm. Even the average American or Canadian citizen, just if they could imagine what it's like, say if it wasn't even an attack on their home, say it was just a natural disaster, and they were not allowed to have construction materials to rebuild their homes, or their town or their city's, you know, sanitation system suffered from an earthquake or something, or some sort of disaster, and they were not allowed to get the parts to repair, mm-hmm. so then they had to suffer from lack of water, lack of proper sewage functions. Just, can we imagine how that would feel on a daily basis for years and years and years? I don't think we can, but I hope that people would try to imagine, because then get a small glimpse of what it's like in Gaza.
Yeah, and what do we need to do? I mean, as Americans, as Canadians, we have this enormous task of dealing with our government and our culture that supports this. A lot of the culture doesn't understand it. They're kept deliberately ignorant. So what do we do? What do activists like us do in terms of trying to change this?
Speak out, and don't let the long propagated Israeli narrative of Arabs are terrorists. Mm-hmm. Don't let that narrative continue. Speak out about what's really going on, the oppression of Palestinians, about their basic rights, fundamental rights, about, you know, that the refugees should be allowed to return, about the current policies Israel's imposing on Palestinians. So speaking out and not being afraid to speak out, because the Jewish lobby in America and in Canada has been very effective in silencing people, silencing academia, for showing documentaries in their classes or for speaking out about Palestinian rights. And, you know, people have lost their jobs, but we need to step beyond that and be strong and, you know, be in solidarity with them. But also, in terms of America, I don't know how this can happen, but we need to stop that money going to Israel. We need to demand that our tax money not go to Israel, that it be used for social services here.
What do you think the role that the boycott, divestment, and sanctions, the BDS movement, has in all of this? It seems to be gaining some strength, at least in Europe. Do you think we need to support that and build that as a nonviolent means of trying to take on Israel?
I think it's one of many forms of resistance that can be impactful. I mean, all forms of resistance are legitimate because mm-hmm. Palestine is occupied. But yeah, the BDS is gaining grounds, and I know that I can't name the universities, but I think Cornell is one of them. I know many universities, there are professors or bodies that have taken a strong stance in endorsing BDS. Mm-hmm. And of course, they're coming under fire from the Jewish lobby groups, you know, that are saying, I know this has happened recently, and I, since I'm on the speaking tour, I'm not really up to date with where it was, but they've come under fire, you know, saying if you endorse BDS or take part in BDS, we'll cut your funding or something like that. But I do think it has impact. I mean, there's different angles to it. There's people that completely endorse boycotting and divesting from any Israeli product, which I support. There's people that only endorse, you know, boycotting settlement or colony products.
Right, like SodaStream.
But anyway, I think it could be one of the things that actually does bring justice. And if not, it's still a means of educating people. It's a means of bringing attention to the issue that is largely whitewashed.
Yeah. I think the other thing we need to talk about is the apartheid nature of that society, because in our country, we understand Jim Crow to a large extent. We're coming to understand it more and more, the history of segregation and discrimination in this country, and we think that's terrible and good. And yet, the Israeli society is really an apartheid society, has policies of apartness, policies that separate people.
Yeah.
And that's not understood very well. And I think one of the things we need to do is to talk more about that, is to really be able to portray that society as an apartheid society, as a separatist society, as a society that favors some people above others and grants benefits to some people mm-hmm. above others. And I think it's another tool in our toolbox to use to talk about Zionism and not only what it's doing here, but what it's doing Israel, what is, I mean, you know, in terms of that society, anyway.
Yeah, on a personal level, like I've seen some of the, in the occupied West Bank, for example, the Jewish-only roads, there's mm-hmm. a highway called 443,
right,
which is like a shortcut for people coming from Tel Aviv or other parts going to Jerusalem. They just go through the West Bank. And Palestinians, of course, are not allowed on that road.
Anyway.
And it means then that they already have to detour for various reasons for the roadblocks and the checkpoints. But then highways, Jewish-only highways, also mean that they have to detour through a network of mm-hmm. back roads and tunnels, etc. But then even within the Jewish state itself, there are Adullah, which looks a lot at Israeli policies within Israel. It has a document that says that something like 50, there are 50 or more racist laws discriminating between Jews and non-Jews.
Mm-hmm.
So Palestinians who hold Israeli citizenship don't have the same laws as Jewish Israelis.
Yeah, and some of it's very subtle. For instance, if you serve in the military, you get this enormous web of benefits, and of course, only certain people can serve in the military. You have 20% of the Israeli population are Palestinian or people of Arab descent, and for the most part, they can't serve in the military. Not that they would, but it is a way to sort of implement part of this discriminatory policy, is to say, well, if you've been in the military, you get this, or you know, and if not, you don't.
Desmond Tutu has spoken out quite strongly about Israel's apartheid-like policies.
Right.
Also, I'd like to plug a Palestinian academic in Gaza, Haider Eid. He does a lot of good work. And
yes.
I think I do always like to, I mean, so here I am, a non-Palestinian. You're a non-Palestinian. We're talking about Palestine. Mm. I think it's important to acknowledge the Palestinian voices, too, you know, that are doing really solid work. So Haider is a very good example of
that. And Dr. Ayad El-Sarraj, who's, of course, we lost. He died not too long ago. But he was such an important voice for us because he came here. Mm-hmm. And some of us that were fortunate enough to go to Gaza and meet with him, but he was able to talk about the plight of children, what's happening to the mental health of children in Gaza, the terrible conditions, and what that does to individuals. Those voices are so important. We're certainly going to miss his.
Yeah, he's a very good man, very compassionate, intelligent man.
Right.
I remember being on a program in Chicago, ABC Television Network, and the debate was with one of the top people at the AMA and myself, debating the benefits of fiber. I remember one of the statements that this man made was that, well, fiber is good for pigs and cows, but humans really don't need a lot of it. Indeed, at that time, the average American was consuming under 5 grams of fiber a day. Needless to say, constipation and diverticular conditions were rampant. What if you were to hear that interview from 1972 or 3, 45 years later? You would say, well, that was prescient. You were ahead of the curve. And indeed now, 40 to 50 grams of fiber is necessary, plus all the good bacteria that got biome and all that does to help our immune system. But back then, nobody wanted to hear it. Medicine, science didn't believe it, didn't want to hear it. They were wrong. And that's why I thought that you would find today's interview with Eva Bartlett relevant. And also important because she was right. The entire mainstream media was wrong. She won't be honored. She won't be acknowledged for being right. Because had we listened to her back in March 13, 2014, when this interview occurred, and we acted upon that information and did honest, independent investigations, think of the amount of suffering that could have been prevented. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need escalate.